Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Feeling a little disorganized, overwhelmed by stuff, like a bit of a mess? Well, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Tim Harford is an economist and an author. His latest book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. So whether talking about creativity or our personal lives or businesses, Harford mounts a powerful defense for messy desks and last-minute decisions and imperfect systems. Could be just what the doctor ordered if you are suffering from a case of Marie Kondo overload. And Tim, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So messy is a quality we often associate with creative people, musicians. So let's start by talking about the best-selling piano album of all time. This is Keith Jarrett's Köln Concert. How did mess help make this album great?
Well, if you had been there the afternoon before the concert, you would not have predicted that this was going to be a bestseller. There'd been a mistake, and Keith Jarrett was facing playing this improvised concert, no rehearsal, packed house, on the wrong piano, a version that was had the keys sticking out of tune, the pedals weren't working, the felt had all worn away, and the instrument was too quiet. It couldn't actually reach to the back of the Cologne Opera House. So naturally, he didn't even want to play, but he felt that he had to. And he recorded this improvised performance because he wanted a documentary record of what a musical catastrophe sounded like. But of course, it wasn't a musical catastrophe. It was magic. It was absolutely beautiful. And as you said, the most successful solo jazz album in history. And you might say, well, what was it then? How did that work? Well, he basically had to adjust the way he played the piano. So he was avoiding the upper registers because they sounded tinny. So he stuck to the middle of the keyboard. That made it sound quite ambient and soothing. But because the piano was so quiet, he was standing up and pounding down on the keys. And this gave the piece this contradictory energy of restfulness and dynamism. And it's an absolutely magical piece of music. Two of my children, by the way, were born to this piece of music. And it was responding to the piano that created the magic.
Well, he's a genius, a musical genius. In lesser hands, would it have been the same thing?
Well, if I sat down and played a piano improvised in front of a full auditorium, I'm sure it would be a disaster. But let me give you an everyday example of what is basically the same thing. So a couple of years ago, my fellow Londoners found themselves stuck in a difficult situation because the London Underground network was partly closed down for 2 days by a strike. So about half the stations were closed. Now, they then had to find a different way to get to work. You can't really drive in London, so they had to maybe get the bus, get the overground train, cycle, take a different route on the underground network to a station that was open, find various different solutions. And when researchers studied how people had actually got to work, they had all this data from these smart cards everyone uses to travel around London. They found that thousands and thousands of Londoners had changed their commuting route because of the strike and then didn't change back. So the interruption, the closure of these stations made them realise there was actually a better way to do things all along, but they didn't realize that until they were disrupted, until they were forced out of their habits. And Keith Jarrett, yes, he's a genius, but he had a particular way of playing the piano. He could have played the Köln concert on any piano, but it was only when he was forced to adapt and forced to play in a certain way that he realized that this was a style he could adopt.
So breaking expectations, forcing, responding to force, adaptation. It's a broad kind of idea of mess. Well, what does the word mess mean to you?
It's a messy concept, I have to admit. In a way, the easiest way I found to understand it is to think about the tendencies that oppose mess. So we have a tendency to want to travel on the underground, on the tube network, the same way every day. We have a tendency to want to play on a perfect piano. So we're perfectionists in that way. If we give a speech, we want to prepare it. We don't want to be winging things. We like to know what our schedule's going to be. We like to deal with familiar people and people who are like us, people who express opinions like us and have experiences like us. We feel uncomfortable coping with strangers. And of course, in this very superficial way, we feel proud of ourselves if we have a tidy desk, and we feel guilty if we have a messy desk. So all of these ways, we love to tidy up, and we love to prepare, and we love to quantify and to surround ourselves with the familiar. But actually, mess and disorganization and improvisation, I think, actually does us a lot of good, even though it makes us feel uncomfortable.
Well, you use the example in this year's election where it can be used almost as a strategy. Up until these past few weeks, how did Donald Trump use mess to his political advantage?
Well, I would actually say not just a strategy, it's a weapon. And mess can be a weapon in any kind of competition. I describe in the book not just Trump, but also Greenpeace, the campaigning organization, Erwin Rommel, great World War II general, the boxer Tyson Fury, who won the world championship, that various examples. But what all of these people had in common was this feeling that the more chaos there is on the battlefield or in the boxing ring, wherever, the more chaos there is, we're all at a disadvantage, but I will be able to cope with the chaos better. I can think faster, I can adapt better, possibly I have less to lose, and thus chaos is to my advantage. And Trump used that very effectively, particularly in the primary campaign, where he had a lot of competitors who were made to seem very ponderous and slow-moving. You really got the idea that Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush, you remember those guys? They used to be the favorites to be the Republican nominee, right? It was going to be Bush versus Clinton. Jeb Bush was going to be the guy. Trump destroyed them all because he made them look so slow. They all went off, consulted their focus groups, figured out the perfect message, came back. But by the time they came back with a perfect message, Trump had fired off another tweet and we were onto the next news cycle and onto the next thing. Now, he may well be running out of luck now. And I don't endorse this. I'm not saying this is a wonderful thing. What I'm saying is it's an effective strategy and it's been used time and time again, often by underdogs, to unsettle better established opponents.
So it's kind of scrappy. But when is mess, you know, just too messy? The line after which a little disorganization becomes an absolute liability, unable to rein it in.
I don't think it's possible to say that in every circumstance, because it's going to depend on the situation. What I do find is that we tend to draw the line in the wrong place. So we tend to get very nervous about disruption and about physical disorder and about unfamiliar situations long before they're doing us any harm. So just to give you a simple example, a wonderful psychological study conducted by a psychologist called Catherine Phillips, where she asked small groups of people to solve problems. And in some cases, they were four friends. But in other cases, she created this perfectly awkward situation of three friends plus a stranger trying to solve the same problem. And it's just, can't quite figure out the social niceties of that. And people felt really uncomfortable. And they also felt they hadn't done a good job solving the problem. But in fact, these mixed groups, the groups with the three friends and the stranger, they actually did far better at finding solutions to the problems than the complacent, comfortable groups of four friends. So we draw the line in the wrong place.
So setting one off balance, there's a sort of, I don't know, is there a mental state that reflects a sort of physical state? I mean, if you have a mess on your desk, is that sign of somebody who's thinking creative on their feet?
I think actually often a messy desk just indicates that we're busy, we've got lots to do. And often because we're busy and we've got lots to do, we feel a little bit stressed and anxious. And then we blame the mess. But I think we've got it completely backwards. I mean, my desk is tidy when there's not a lot going on because, you know, I tidy it up, it's fine. When I'm really, really busy working on lots of projects, my desk starts to get very messy and I feel stressed, but it's not actually the messy desk that's causing the stress. It's the fact that I'm busy.
I'm speaking with Tim Harford. He's an economist and author who argues that instead of tidying up, maybe we should be tidying down. His new book is called Messy: The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. Well, if mess is such a good thing, Tim, why do you think that Marie Kondo's book, The Art of Tidying Up, has been so popular, resonating with so many people? Isn't the average person sort of dealing with too much mess, too much clutter already?
Well, I'm actually a big fan of Marie Kondo's book. My wife and I bought it and we read it and we said, this is brilliant, and we decluttered our house. So I think she's onto something really important. Where it doesn't work is when you're sitting in your workplace at your desk, or maybe you have a home study, or maybe you've just got a pile of bills on the dining room table and you've got 100 emails a day coming in and all these different bits of paper. And Marie Kondo's philosophy is, well, take everything in your hand and ask yourself whether it sparks joy. You can't manage your email inbox like that. Mm-hmm. She's talking about something else. And I'm talking about how you deal with these much more mundane processes of filtering all the miscellaneous information we deal with every day.
So you can roll up all your socks and get rid of all the things that don't spark joy. That gives you some sense of order. But what about the dangers of the over-sterilized systems, you know, that try to eliminate mess altogether? Are there risks there?
Well, I think there are. And there's a balancing act. It's very hard for us to get our heads around. But one of the examples I give in the book is of this mysterious flight of Air France 447, which took off from Brazil towards Paris and then disappeared. And for a long time, people couldn't understand what had happened. This is a very safe aeroplane. And eventually the cockpit recordings came out. And it became clear that basically what had happened is the pilots had been trusting the autopilot to fly the plane for them. Not just in the way we think of, like, the autopilot is controlling the plane, but that the autopilot was interpreting every move the pilots made. It was like a very sympathetic translator. You pull on the joystick in quite a violent way, and the autopilot interprets that and says, okay, well, you know, you must have meant to move the plane gently to the left, so that's the instructions I will actually deliver to the aircraft. And at a certain point, that translator function that made the flying so smooth and so effortless, that translator function broke. And suddenly the pilots were in direct control of the aircraft, and they had no training, they had no practice. And in the end, tragically, they crashed it. And this is called the paradox of automation. So the more that we hand over control to computers and autopilots, who are very good and very safe in many cases, the less competent we become, the less practice we get. And then in those rare cases, when the computer hands it back to us and says, actually, this is something I can't cope with, we're facing a very unusual situation. We're totally surprised and we're totally untrained. And that's happening in the airline industry very, very rarely, but occasionally. It's going to happen a lot more. Now we are trusting computers to identify who's a terrorist, or we're trusting computers to drive our cars. We are losing some of our human skills because the computers make it look so neat and so tidy. It's a problem.
Well, you're talking about training pilots, for one thing, you know, to be calm, and or that they should have more experience training and actually using the controls themselves and not autopilot. And in the book, you write about, you know, Brian Eno and David Bowie, you know, musical geniuses that had this kind of chaotic process, or Steve Jobs, Martin Luther King Jr. But is being able to function inside of mess something that you can train people to do? I mean, are some people not just those kind of type A individuals who can't easily incorporate mess into their lives?
I think it's very important that we try not to force a particular way of working on anybody. One of the things that I write about in the book is these managers who have tidy desk policies. When you look at the psychological research, letting people decide how their own space looks, you know, tidy if you want it to be tidy, messy if you want it to be messy, giving people control and autonomy over their space is incredibly important for their well-being and their productivity. But very often we get a particular idea in our minds about how things should look. Maybe they should be super minimalist. Maybe they should be playful with spirals and murals and all the cool toys you have in some of the really cool offices. But we impose this vision on workers. And actually, all they want is to be left alone to manage their own space.
Are there any lessons that you took away from some of these really creative people who did great things existing and functioning within that kind of messy spiral?
Well, something that I found really inspiring was Martin Luther King's evolution as a speaker. Early in his career, he would prepare his speeches very, very carefully, 15 hours of preparation for every Sunday sermon. And he would memorize it, and it would last 15 or 20 minutes. So he was preparing for an hour for every minute of delivery. And he was a good speaker. But then later on, he started becoming involved with the civil rights movement, and he was suddenly thrust into the forefront of the Montgomery bus boycott. His young daughter had just been born. He was sleep deprived. He felt uncertain. He wasn't sure he should really be there. And then suddenly he's responsible for representing this movement to the nation. And he has to go and give a speech in front of a larger crowd than he's ever spoken in front of before. The television cameras, the newspapermen, and he doesn't have his 15 hours. He's got 15 minutes. And there's an amazing passage in his autobiography where he describes his confusion and just trying to settle his mind, make a couple of notes about what he wants to say, really just the briefest sketch, and then a moment of prayer. And then he drives to the Holt Street Church and he gives the greatest speech of his life. Because he's let go, he's abandoned preparation, and instead he's there in the moment. And from then on, he kept doing that, and he was really forced into it. And that's a message, I think, for all of us. Of course, we're not all great speakers like Martin Luther King, but sometimes, like Keith Jarrett, like Martin Luther King, or just like those commuters in London, sometimes when we're forced into it, we find a better way to do things.
Beautiful mess. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Tim Harford, he's an economist, BBC radio host, and an author, and his latest book is called Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.